This is Near FM
90.3.
Former academic Alan Tuffrey, good afternoon, Alan. And when you picked our topic for discussion this afternoon, I could not wait to talk to you about it. What kind of a society do we want? Now, can I start this chat by taking you back to your homeland, dear boy, because there is a thing unfolding in your homeland at the moment called Brexit. It is affecting different parts of Britain in different ways, but I would venture to say that it is only affecting the extremely wealthy in a positive way. Now, and it's affecting everybody around Europe and the world in different ways. And the reason that I want to start there, Alan, is the question posed is, what kind of a society do we want? Could I put it to you that Brexit was sold to the British people on the pretext of creating a better society than the one they already had, but the sunny uplands do not seem to be in view just yet?
Yeah, I think good day to you. Brexit is a bad case making bad law, I think. And I think it was sold on a very dodgy premise of national sovereignty. Where I think you're on very dodgy ground as soon as you utter like national sovereignty, and we would have our own autonomy. Anybody who thought about it knew that it would cause problems, I think. But it was sold on those vague problems, and it's a good example of how we've learned to look across the water there to my native land. My homeland is here now, Donny, if I may quibble, and Sonny Rahini. And over there, we look across the channel now to see how not to do things. You know, just as we could run a referendum properly here and with a citizens' assembly and all, they showed how not to do it. But anyway, they're not a good example. But there's a school of thought that says, you judge a society by how the weakest people, if I may use a term like weakest people, fare. People with the most needs, people with disabilities and so on, and people who don't have good jobs or refugees or any of, how do those people fare? And I love a good quotation, so I found one on this one from Theodore Roosevelt. There's a person now. We do nothing but class here. This country will not be a permanently good place for any of us to live in unless we make it a reasonably good place for all of us to live in. Now, that's hitting the nail on the head in about 25 words or fewer. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And then we can ask ourselves, how equal is this society? And there's an increasing inequality in most Western societies, and including our own, which must be the wrong way to be going. And the weakest people in our society are people who are not working for one reason or another. There are those who choose not to work. That's fine. That's their choice. But there are lots of other reasons why people don't work. Disability is an obvious one. Chronic ill health, another. Family responsibilities. Think of the number of women, particularly, who are caring for children or elderly relatives. And I don't see why the inability to work should exclude people from having a half-decent life and not having to worry where the next bill is going to be paid or the next meal is going to come from, which leads to other bad consequences. But I sense that you're fired up here, Donny, and you're raring to go.
Well, I'd like to think, Alan, that I have somewhat of a social conscience. And you mentioned Theodore Roosevelt there, and for those who may not be aware of it, along with being the 26th president of America, he is also the man after whom the teddy bear was named, believe it or not. And a lot of people may not know that, as Michael Caine would say. But the thought came to mind, Alan, when you mentioned him and his definition of it. If the man was to return today and see America as it is right now, and I am thinking particularly, and I'm not even going to go down the road of the disenfranchised and the massive inequality that exists within that society and has done for a long time. But I'm just going to pick one cohort of people. I wonder if Teddy Roosevelt came back today and saw how a lot of American military veterans are living and are treated. What would he think of his country?
That's a good example, Donny. Military veterans who often have post-traumatic stress disorders, as well as having all sorts of psychological traumas arising from their trade as trained killers and all the rest of it, and trained all sorts of things, other things as well. But it can be very hard for veterans, as we know, to fit back into society. And you're right, the USA is an extremely unequal society, but veterans are not treated well. They're not given the supports they need to reintegrate or to fall, not even reintegrate. They may choose not to reintegrate. They may choose to have a different kind of life. That's okay too. But they do need supports to do that. And I think that's where there should be supports for people who need support. People shouldn't be struggling and left outside society and left as useless people. There's a good term. People who can't enjoy their lives is what I mean by useless. I don't mean economically useless. I reject that as a criterion. And if you look at the kind of political comment in this country, and I'm going to go back a few years to quote one of our political leaders in this country, whose current party political leader said a couple of years ago, I want to lead a party for people who get up early in the morning or get up in the morning. And there's a lot of talk also about working families. Now, if you examine what's meant by these, are we saying that only the people who go to work are actually worthwhile? People have stay at home and work, I suppose, these days. Are these the only worthwhile people? Are we saying that the people who don't go to work for one reason or another are somehow bad people and deserve to be maltreated, driven out to work? This seems to be, if that's the case, and I think it's an unspoken view, that seems to be a reflection of a 19th century view that poverty is ordained and is generally good for society because it discourages the poor from breathing or from living too long, which is generally good for society. Well, I don't think too many people in Ireland today would accept that as a decent worldview and a basis for society.
No, Alan, can I just say something there in relation to that? Because it's something that through my interviews and my work here, I would profess to know a little bit about. When Mr. Varadkar made that utterance, and definitely it was, and if he's listening, I make no apology for saying this one, or for saying this, that it was definitely an occasion where he only opened his mouth so that he could change his feet. Because quite a number, in fact a disturbing number, of working families are living now in emergency accommodation because the money generated from the work they do is not sufficient for them to put their own roof over their head. And the other thing that I want to put to you in relation to that, Alan, is this. You know, you're 100% right, of course. Society, and this is the whole kernel of it, society is looked upon and is really a barometer of how it treats its weakest and its poorest and its most needy, I think is the best way to the word I can use. And I'm grasping for words, as you can understand. But given that, with a couple of notable exceptions like China, North Korea, Russia, and a few others thrown in, we live in pretty much a democratic society. And from my knowledge of it, democracy around the world seems to fall into two cohorts. You have the left and you have the right. The right seem to think that no matter how much money you spend on the disenfranchised and the needy, it's too much. And the left seem to think that no matter how much you spend on them, it's not enough. So am I getting close to the kernel of where our problems are seated?
Yes, I think, yes. I would go that way. It's a shorthand terminology which we could use while we're sitting around chatting about these things. Yes, I think the right does generally regards the interference of the state in whatever form as a bad thing. And we've talked about that briefly and we've touched on it repeatedly. And welfare is a bad thing. And you mentioned the situation in the UK. I heard a figure the other day that the National Health Service, the jewel in the crown, as their prime minister called it, round about Brexit, I think, said it costs something like 44% of GDP. Now, you can imagine that the extreme right wing, by which I don't mean fascist, I mean the right wing of the Conservative Party, 44% of all state earnings is going on one bit of welfare services. Why can't they pay for their own health care? That's, you know, we can just nearly hear that sort of phrase going on. And the left, yes, they want to spend more and more. The problem with some of the left is they don't want to pay for it. So they want to have services of all kinds without being taxed to pay for it. Now, I'm sorry, you can't have services. Everything has to be paid for. That's a harsh reality in this world. It has to be paid for. Now, I'm happy to sit here and say I would have no objection to paying a higher taxes if I thought it was going to help people who need it. The needy, I think it's a very good expression that you use there. The needy, those who need it, or if we had a better health service instead of one with nearly a million people on waiting lists, which is not acceptable, I think, in a country, an affluent country as Ireland is. This is a very affluent country. We're extremely affluent in world terms, and indeed within our own terms. Most of us are very well off, and we should be working towards less equality. Greater equality, I should say. Yeah, so a lot of this stuff is the attitude that comes out, as you say, the politician who spoke was perhaps misspeaking, I think is what they say nowadays. It was an unfortunate phrase, but they do talk about working families a lot. And I think that these phrases show the same underlying attitude, which may be unconscious, that it's almost... as a former British Prime Minister, whose name I won't mention for fear of upsetting your listeners, she said that, you know, it's almost a crime to be poor. You shouldn't. It's your fault if you're poor. Well, that really is a 19th century attitude, and I don't think we could accept that nowadays. So, there's
but even that it's a despicable thing to say, Alan, and. As I mean, it goes without saying, it's despicable, and it has no place in any society, not even in Victorian times did that have a place. But irrespective of that, do you think that there is that sort of an inbuilt and ingrained bias and I'm looking for another word here now, and I have to pick them very carefully because I don't want to be drawing the ire of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland on me, but that there is that sort of an inbuilt bias racism even among certain elements in society.
Yeah, it's an unconscious prejudice, I think, Donny, is the way I might put it. People, without really examining it, that idea we talked about last time we were conversing, we talked about examining ideas. People don't really examine that underlying idea. People who don't work, for whatever reason, people in general who aren't working, must be idle. They must be shiftless, and we need to make them go back to work by incentives of one kind or another. That's another word which is could do with unpacking a bit. But and I think there is an unconscious prejudice there. It may be conscious in some cases, in any case, I think it needs to be looked at. And I think it doesn't bear scrutiny, would be my view. And I think we have to examine that and throw it out if we think it is a bad idea, and then try and find a way of doing it and making life better for people. And there's evidence out there that there are ways of doing that. when we talk about incentives to work, what do we mean by incentives? Does that mean keeping people so poor that they are driven out to work? And any sort of work is preferable to not working, even though it doesn't, and you've mentioned people, the working poor, who can't keep a roof over their heads and can't feed themselves properly and look after their kids properly or themselves, to have that complicated system there. And the social welfare system is enormously complicated. I don't know about you, Donny, but I got a pamphlet through the door at the weekend from a local public representative, shall I say. It's equivalent of, it's a very expensively produced pamphlet on social welfare, Know Where You Stand, A Guide to Your Entitlements, right? It's the equivalent of 3 A4 pages in very small print of detailed stuff about how you, this grant, that grant, pensions and social welfare. Now, you know, I'm a highly educated academic. Now, I'm not about to wade through that to find out am I missing. Now, I'm fortunate, I'm not starving by a long shot. But somebody who is really struggling to keep their family going, to keep children fed and shod, they're going to sit down and study this and say, oh, I'm entitled to this, and then go out and make 4 or 5 different applications online, which they may not be easy for them. And, you know, the hurdles in people's way to access these funds are enormous. And the cost of policing these systems and managing these systems is hugely expensive. So, and if you look at solutions, there is a possible solution out there. I may have touched on this. And one of your other contributors, Michelle Murphy from Social Justice Ireland, I think has spoken and written about some of this stuff. It's known that the cure for poverty is cash. If you give people money, they will improve their positions. And there's a term for this. It's called universal basic income, sometimes UBI, universal basic income. And what this means is you give everybody, you know, we can quibble about ages and cutoffs and one thing and another, enough to give them a start in life. And you can see how that would immediately cause, we'll come to the results on the effects on the recipients, but that could reduce and simplify social welfare costs. It's probably called family support or something nowadays. Social welfare costs enormously, because you don't have to have all these different grants. You don't have to have all the incentives and make people attend courses that they don't need and don't want to do. But it makes everything much simpler. So there's a saving there. And you can do that. Now, so the other people may say, those who don't work are probably just bone idle and they'll waste away their time. And if you give them money, they'll drink it or they'll spend it at the bookies or they'll do other useless things with it. But the evidence out there is that that's not what happens. And there's loads of evidence there. A book I've mentioned before on this program, because I keep mentioning it because it's one of the two most influential books I've read in the last probably decade. It's Bregman's Utopia for Realists. What a great title that is. And it's based on the phrase that he's fond of, is today's utopia is tomorrow's commonplace. In other words, something that is only a pipe dream today just becomes something nobody thinks twice about tomorrow. And he, in this book, among other things, he does several other things in this book, he talks about the effects of giving people money, from the homeless on the streets of Amsterdam or The Hague, and just giving people money, and what happens to these people. And there are good studies out there, of which perhaps the most famous is called the Mincom study from Canada. It was in 1973, which is what, 3 decades ago? Oh, sorry, it's 5 decades ago, is it? My math is notoriously bad. It's the biggest experiment that was ever done. There were 13,000 inhabitants of Mincom, and they were given the equivalent of $19,000 each for every year. The program ran for 4 years, and then, of course, you can nearly see what's coming. There was a change of government, a much more conservative government came in, pulled the plug, pulled all the funding for the programme, which had a very intense data collection and analysis, and it was just the plug was pulled. But and the data, massive amounts of data, was all stacked up in boxes, because we're talking pre-computer era here, stacked up in boxes and left in an archive somewhere until an academic found it, and she organised a complete analysis of this. And she, to cut a long story short, she came out that the following were the main outcomes. The marriage rate, especially amongst the young, fell. Birth rate fell. Now, those two things often go together, because we all know that young girls in some areas of the needy populations tend to get pregnant very young for all sorts of educational and perhaps cultural reasons. But marriage rate, especially amongst the young, fell. So did birth rate. There are too many of us anyway. School performance went up. The number of work hours reduced, because there are those who say if you give people money, they won't work, went down by almost nothing. I think it was 1%, which is the nearest thing to nothing you can have. The number of people going into hospital went down by 8.5%. That's a lot of people. That's about 1 in 12, isn't it? And most of the spending was accounted for by increased childcare and education. Adults educating themselves to give themselves better chances of jobs and all the rest of it. So, in other words, people spent their money on better parenting, looking after their kids better, and personal, what we might call personal development, including their education, which is obviously a good thing, I would say, as an educator. So you can see that kind of result is replicated in numerous studies all over the world. There was one study, there was a proposal in the States, and if you're a better man than I am for knowing your American presidents, formidable in a quiz, I would say, Richard Nixon, almost.
Tricky Dicky,
about whom nobody has a good word to say these days, and perhaps they might be right. But he was within a hair's breadth of implementing a national program across the entire United States of universal basic income. And the program, in Bregman's terms, in his book, was pretty well sabotaged by a guy who violently disapproved of it, and seized on a very bad and negative report on a similar program from 150 years earlier, which was the classic case at the time. And the plug was pulled, and that didn't happen. Can you imagine how different the United States of America would have been? Nixon, being a Republican, could probably have implemented it. Probably.
And I wouldn't mind, but I mean, that is the type of policy that you would expect Bernie Sanders to be coming out with, who is an extreme. In fact, he's so far to the left of the Democrats, he's not even a Democrat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he would be regarded in United States terms as an extreme communist, I'm sure.
Definitely. But I mean, that is the type of policy that I would expect him to be coming out with today. Yeah. Never mind Richard Nixon back in the 70s.
I mean, it's a staggering thought, isn't it, that Nixon was on the cusp of doing it. I mean, almost a hair's breadth of doing it. And, you know, he's effectively turned by those who opposed it. Some even more right-wing Republicans.
Alan, you mentioned something there, which I want to go back to, and it was, you know, the various reasons why, excuse me, some people are not in what would be termed gainful employment, and one of the things that you mentioned was, and it pertains particularly to women, and we're not, neither Alan nor myself are being sexist when we say that, but it is a fact, who choose sometimes no choice of their own. They're forced into staying at home to look after maybe a child with disabilities, maybe a parent with disabilities, or maybe even a partner who has a disability through accident or illness. And before anybody jumps up and down and says, oh, well, there's plenty out there for them, number one, try accessing it. But far, far more importantly, I would suggest, and there are studies in this, and I'm almost certain that somebody that Alan referred to, Michelle Murphy, published a study on this. If she didn't, somebody very close to her did. on exactly, and I'll go back to old money here, down to pounds, shillings and pence, what those people are actually saving the Exchequer. That's a frightening figure for you.
Yes, that's right. This is one of the things we keep talking about, GDP. We and economists and everybody talk about GDP as a measure of economy. None of that work is measured by GDP. And neither of us has the figure to hand, but it's probably in the tens, if not hundreds of millions. It's huge amounts of money, and it's not measured by GDP. It doesn't count in terms of economy and for work. If you can't put a price on it and you can't sell it, it's not measured by GDP, in effect. If you get an economist coming on to complain that I got it wrong, well, that's fair enough. I'll take it on the chin. I'm not an economist. But it doesn't measure that work, and it is huge, as is the cost of childcare, the effort that people put in. Not I'm suggesting for one moment that the state should be looking after every child in the country. I think it's a pretty daft idea. And I don't mind ideas being daft, by the way, as your listeners will know.
but in a way, Alan, and I know we're going to run over on this, and I can't really afford it because I'm going to Glasgow shortly for a report from the COP26. But in a way, they do, and I think it's absolutely ludicrous. And I just want a 30-second snippet for you on this. We have a thing in this country. I don't know what it's called now, but I know when my kids were small, it was called the children's allowance. Irrespective of what your bank balance says, you're going to get that. And even if you don't want it, it's going to be forced upon you.
Yes.
Absolutely ludicrous. And the man, whom a lot of people may not have that good to say for, mind you, was Michael O'Leary from Ryanair, who has for years contended that there is absolutely no way in the wide walls of the world that his wife should have to trek down to the post office every month to collect children's allowance, that he doesn't need it and doesn't want it. But she has no choice. She has to take it. Whereas if they kept that same pot of money but made it means tested. Now, I don't mean cut it down.
I know what you mean. No, the other way of doing that, that's a kind of universal basic income, if you like. It's a universal basic income for children. It's not enough to live on it, but it's a contribution. And for those for whom it's important, it's very important. But the same principle applies to universal basic income. Everybody gets it. Michael O'Leary doesn't need it. I probably don't need it. But it would be very easy to adjust the tax bands to effectively take it back off me again. None of that is hugely difficult for the people who know how to do this, the economists who know how to adjust tax bands. We can adjust the tax bands. So I get paid whatever it is. Let's pick a number, 12,000 a year as a universal basic income. I don't need another 12,000 years. I'm very comfortably off, thank you very much. I wouldn't know what to do with 12,000 a year, quite frankly.
I can help you, no problem at all. Just give me a shout.
I was waiting for that. You're a very kind donor. If it ever happens, I'll be sending for you. Yeah.
Alan, unfortunately, and I know that this is a topic, and it's a topic actually, I think, in fairness to ourselves and in fairness to the topic at hand and in fairness to the listeners, that we're going to have to come back to near future, because there is so much in this, and in fact, I think it's something that's going to become even more prevalent as the winter rolls on, because the amount of money coming into the houses is going down, and the amount of money going out is going up. Former academic Alan Tuffrey, as always, Alan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
A pleasure, Donny. Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Near FM
90.3.